Hi, thank you, David. It's really good to be here and to talk about the role that implicit bias can play in larger upstream determinants of health. I will jump right into my talk to leave adequate time for the discussion. So I want to begin by affirming the fact that racism is is as American as apple pie. It's deeply embedded in American culture. And one way to think of that is to look at the work of some researchers that have put together a database of American culture. The Beagle Project contains about 10 million words, and it's a sample of what the average college-educated American would read in their entire lifetime. So you have all of American culture put together in a database. If you have American culture in a database, you can analyze it. And you can look at the association when certain words occur within American culture, what tends to co-occur with it. So when black occurs in American culture, so this is a summary of what Americans have seen over their lifetime, black typically occurs with poor and violent and religious and lazy and cheerful and dangerous. So that's what the average American has been fed by being a part of American society. For comparison, when white occurs, wealthy, progressive, conventional, stubborn, successful, educated. Female, for interest, distant, warm, gentle, passive. Male, dominant, leader, logical, strong. The point I want to make to begin with is that we are not tabula rasa. We have all been fed as being a part of this society. Certain words have been associated with certain characteristics. And what research shows is unconscious or implicit bias is that when you have internalized those messages that you have received, and you hold a negative implicit bias, a negative stereotype, a negative association about a different social category, and you meet someone who fits that category, it's automatic and it's unconscious. You will treat that person differently with no intent on your part and without even being aware of the fact that you've done it. That's what we're talking about when we say implicit bias. And it occurs among persons who are not prejudiced. And it occurs for most Americans. So, for example, the research on implicit bias in this country shows that between 70 to 80% of all Americans have implicit biases against blacks. So this is not an isolated or a rare phenomenon. It occurs among most Americans, even persons who have sympathies for the injustice that blacks have felt in the past, even persons who are firmly committed to egalitarian principles, they're nonetheless a part of the larger American society. They have been fed these messages in their culture. These messages are deeply embedded in their subconscious and affects their behavior without their conscious awareness. And the average person would say, I am not racist. I know I don't stereotype. I think the scientific evidence today is conclusive that these stereotypes are activated automatically. In fact, the research suggests they are activated more quickly and effortlessly than conscious cognition, and there are multiple cognitive processes that result in confirmation of these expectancies. If you want to read more about this or look, see how you do, the implicit association test can be found at the website implicit.harvard.edu. It's not the only one, but one of the most widely used tests to capture implicit bias. Banerjee has a wonderful book entitled Blind Spot for someone who wants to dig even more deeply into this. So not surprisingly, if you go back to the high levels of negative stereotyping that I began with, if you look at questionnaire data where you give Americans a seven-point scale, with one of the scale being lazy and one of the scale being hardworking, for example, in the 1990 General Social Survey, 44% of Americans believe that blacks are lazy, 56% that blacks prefer to live off welfare, 51% that blacks are prone to violence, 29% that blacks are unintelligent. Reflecting some of the same stereotypes, the cognitive survey data is reflecting some of the same messages we got from the stereotypes. Not only do whites view blacks negatively, they view blacks much more negatively than they view themselves. So while 56% of whites believe that blacks prefer to live off welfare, only 4% of whites believe that whites prefer to live off welfare. Not only do whites hold these negative stereotypes about blacks, but few endorse the positive stereotypes. One in five or fewer whites were willing to say that blacks are hardworking, prefer to be self-supporting, is not prone to violence, or is intelligent. And you can see the comparison numbers for whites. And someone says, that's 1990 survey, well, okay, before I talk about the 1990 survey data, there is a hierarchy of ranking about the groups asked in the general social survey in 1990. Blacks were viewed the most negatively. Blacks, Hispanics, and Asians were all viewed more negatively than whites, with Hispanics viewed twice as negatively as Asians, with Southern whites viewed more negatively than whites in general, and with Jews viewed more positively than whites in general. I'm illustrating that with the welfare stereotype, but it's true across the board for all of the stereotypes. There's a hierarchy of ranking across various social groups. And you said that's 1990. What has happened since then? Well, two of the stereotypes have been repeated over time, and you could see in 1990, 44% of whites viewed blacks as lazy, and in 2006, it's 33%. So the numbers have gone down, and you would think that maybe we've made progress. Well, maybe not so fast. If you look at the positive end of the stereotype, remember it's asked on a 7-point scale with 4 is neither agree or disagree, and I'm collapsing the lazy end and the hardworking end. If you look at the percent of whites viewing blacks as hardworking, 17% in 1990, 16% in 2006. So what has changed over time is more people moving from the negative to sitting in the middle, and we know that sitting in the middle in part reflects social desirability effects. These negative racial stereotypes, you know, we used to say sticks and bones may break my bones, you know, sticks and stones and break my bones, but words wouldn't hurt me. These negative stereotypes are dramatically consequential for racial inequality in the United States, including racial inequality in health. These negative stereotypes undergird and support and stimulate large-scale societal discrimination. So residential segregation is a driver of racial inequalities in the United States. It's an institutional mechanism of racism, and it is supported by the negative racial stereotypes. Observers of American society for a long time have noted the centrality of residential segregation as a key to understanding racial inequality. John Sell argued it was one of the most successful domestic policies of the 20th century in the United States. It's beneath the radar screen, but it's a driver of racial inequality. And someone says, what does segregation have to do with health? Well, where you live determines your access to educational opportunities, your access to employment opportunities. It determines the quality of neighborhood conditions and housing conditions. It determines whether it's easy or difficult to live a healthy lifestyle. It determines access to high-quality medical care. All of these are things that have been well shown. So, for example, David Cutler, an economist at Harvard University, did a national study looking at blacks and whites and found that if you could statistically eliminate segregation, you would completely erase black-white differences in income, education, and unemployment, and reduce black-white differences in single motherhoods by two-thirds, all of that driven by segregation. Because of segregation, William Julius Wilson and Robert Sampson concluded that the worst urban context in which whites reside is considerably better than the average context of black communities. There are healthy communities and unhealthy communities in the United States on multiple dimensions, and segregated communities tend to be unhealthy communities. America today is just slightly less segregated than South Africa was under legally mandated apartheid in the United States, if you look at the largest cities in the U.S. Research by Maria Kreisen and colleagues have shown that what drives residential segregation today is negative racial stereotypes. Studying a probability sample of whites in metropolitan Detroit and metropolitan Chicago, where they showed these individuals a 35-second video clip of different neighborhoods. The neighborhoods were identical that were shown to the sample. All they varied was whether the three people in the neighborhood that were seen on the street, dressed similarly, were all black, all white, or whether there was a mix of blacks and whites. And what they found was that whites rank an all-white neighborhood more positively on cost, on safety, on future property value, on school quality, than the identical neighborhood if a black person was in the picture. What they also found is that the whites in metropolitan Chicago and Detroit held negative stereotypes about blacks. So 42% of whites said that whites were more intelligent than blacks. 44% said that blacks were more likely than whites to prefer to live off welfare. 70% of whites said that blacks tended to be more involved in crimes and gangs than whites. And 54% of whites said that whites do a better job of raising their children than blacks. And the whites who endorsed these negative stereotypes were more likely to view the neighborhood with a black person more negatively. In other words, on the dimensions that matter to home buyers and that determines residential preferences, negative racial stereotypes views the presence of a black person in the neighborhood as making the neighborhood less valuable on all those dimensions. What I'm saying is, implicit bias then drives the residential segregation that drives racial inequality, and this implicit bias, therefore, creates racial differences in income, education, occupational status, and wealth. Sometimes people talk about them as if they're acts of God that just came out of thin air. They reflect the successful implementation of social policy that has been undergirded and fed by and is today sustained and supported by implicit biases. An example in the area of employment, work of Deva Pager, doing an audit study, sending blacks and whites to apply for an entry-level job, and she finds discrimination. If you had a criminal record, you were less likely to get a call back for a job. But she also found that a black male with a clean record is less likely to get a call back for a job than a white male with a criminal record. The resumes were identical. She repeated the study in New York City and found that the white felon is more likely than the African American with a clean record to get a call back for a job, and also for the Latino, although the difference for the white and the Latino is not statistically significant. So there are these racial differences in socioeconomic status, and I'm saying both institutional discrimination through segregation and interpersonal discrimination, both of them undergirded by implicit biases, contribute to these inequalities. And you can see examples of these inequalities of racial differences in education, racial differences in income. For example, this is data from the U.S. Census, the 2012 report. For every dollar of income that whites earned, blacks earned 63 cents. In that same year, for every dollar of income that whites earned, Hispanics earned 73 cents. An example of the racial ethnic differences in income that persist. Even larger differences exist in wealth. For every dollar of wealth that whites have, blacks and Latinos have 6 cents. And if we exclude home equity and look only at other financial assets, blacks and Latinos have 1 penny for every dollar of financial wealth that whites have. In fact, fully 1/3 of black and Latino households have zero or negative wealth. No economic reserves. And I'm talking about the role of implicit biases in supporting them. In addition to these indirect effects through socioeconomic status and neighborhood context and so on, the discrimination created by implicit bias is literally directly killing African Americans. So, for example, I created the everyday discrimination scale to capture one type of discrimination, that minor but recurrent forms of discrimination, like you're treated with less courtesy than others and treated with less respect than others. And just to highlight the work of just one researcher using that one scale, Dr. Tanya Lewis, she finds that higher levels of everyday discrimination is associated with coronary artery calcification, with C-reactive protein, a measure of inflammation, with elevated blood pressure levels, among pregnant women with given birth to lower birth weight infants, among the elderly, higher levels of cognitive impairment, in a community sample, poorer quality sleep, whether subjectively assessed or assessed by actigraphy. In a sample of the elderly, followed over time, higher levels of discrimination, ACLE is linked to increased risk of mortality. And in a sample of black and white women, higher levels of discrimination is unrelated to waist circumference, unrelated to waist-hip ratio, unrelated to subcutaneous fat, but predicts visceral fat. And visceral fat is the bad kind of abdominal fat that we worry about and that increases your risk of cardiovascular disease. I told Tanya Lewis I've summarized the entire career in one slide, but it's a slide, that illustrates the power of discrimination and the multiple pathways by which discrimination affects health. the acceptance of negative racial stereotypes also produces lower levels of socioeconomic status. And I'm talking about the work of Claude Steele and his colleagues on stereotype threat. What Claude Steele has been able to demonstrate is that if you bring a group of black students good enough to get into Stanford or the University of Michigan into a room and randomly divide them into two groups and tell one group take a test and the other group take the test, but blacks do more poorly in the test than whites, the group told that blacks do more poorly does more poorly. He can produce the effect simply by telling one group of blacks, write your race on the top of the paper before you begin the test, and the group told to write their race does more poorly. This is a more generalizable phenomenon. He can produce the effects in women. If one group of women is told take the test and the other group told take the test, but men do better than women on this test, the group told that women do more poorly does more poorly. He's been able to demonstrate it in white men. If a group of white men are brought in and half are told take the test, the other half told take the test, but whites do more poorly than Asians on the test. The group told that whites do more poorly than Asians does more poorly. But it only occurs in an area of stereotype vulnerability. There has to be the largest societal belief of the vulnerability of your group in that domain. So, for example, Steele shows it works for women on tests of analytic ability, but not on tests of verbal skills, because the stereotype is that women outperform men on verbal skills. An intriguing study looking at Asian American women finds that if you make gender salient that women do poorly, it reduces performance among Asian women. But if you make their race salient that they are Asian, it enhances performance. Another intriguing study about the role of culture and cultural upbringing is work done by Claude Steele and his students in New York City. They did the study with black Caribbean immigrants, and the group told that blacks do more poorly actually did better. But they were not raised in the United States. They were raised outside of the United States, weren't fed the same messages. But their children of black Caribbean immigrants, when told that blacks do more poorly, did more poorly, showing the power of the culture and the socialization to drive outcomes. The point I want to conclude on is that if this deeply embedded racism that shapes implicit bias, that shapes institutional and interpersonal discrimination, one of the challenges we face that we haven't thought about enough about is the need to reduce cultural racism in society. And we need to think of ways in which we develop a strategic long-term plan to reduce cultural racism. There's a lot of research that suggests this is possible. Studies which have mainly focused on attitudes towards gays document that sympathetic media portrayals of a stigmatized group can lead to reduced negative attitudes towards the group and can have many positive effects. Positive media portrayals associated with reductions of prejudice. I give an example. More time spent watching Will and Grace, for example, research shows likable gay characters on TV is associated with lower levels of prejudice towards gays. So we need to think of ways in which we can maximize the use of the media and find campaigns that can be effective strategically in building the kind of new culture where race and racial diversity is celebrated. My conclusions: racism in its multiple forms have emerged as a major risk factor for health and the determinants of health. Implicit bias, birthed by the larger culture, is a driver of these racial inequalities. We need to find effective ways to mitigate its pathogenic effects. We also need to find feasible and optimal strategies to create a political will and support to create a new culture and to create and dismantle the societal structures that support and sustain racism in all its forms, including cultural racism. Thank you.